August 20th, 2015. Here's the takeaway.
This has been a summer of racial violence and racial reflection, from New York City to Baltimore to Ferguson. Talk of black distrust of authority, a white inability to see racial violence as something other than an anomaly, a mental illness. The president has talked about restoring trust. The Confederate flag came down in South Carolina. Debates over the Civil War's real meaning are happening in a new way in this country. Video of police harassment of black teenagers at a swimming pool reveals something the nation might otherwise have ignored. A black woman stopped for a traffic violation died a few days later. There was even the mysterious but disruptive story of Rachel Dolezal claiming to be black, a lie that also suggested that much of what we are taught about race is also a kind of historical lie. Can we really constructively talk about all these things? Black former North Carolina State Senator Malcolm Graham says yes, we can. But he also brings a piece of painful personal history to the discussion. His sister, a librarian, Cynthia Graham Hurd, was one of the shooting victims at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina this summer. Malcolm says whites and blacks can move quickly in these times, from tragedy to racial symbols and then beyond. In our conversation yesterday, Senator Malcolm Graham led the way.
It's unfortunate that it took a tragedy to occur in order for the flag to come down. I think you, as well as I know, that if Charleston did not occur, that flag would still be flying high today. And so this just cannot be a moment in time. It has to be the beginning of more progressive thinking in South Carolina about a whole host of issues that tend to divide people versus bringing them together.
You know, it's been quite a summer. Did you follow that Rachel Dolezal business out west earlier in the summer?
Yeah. And, you know, that and what happened in Texas. I think the thing that really comes to my memory is watching TV and watching the police respond to the pool party in Texas, where they came to break up what was a disturbance. The police officer, a white officer, comes and he seemed to be more out of control than anyone at the party, doing barrel rolls and pulling out his gun and then putting his knee in the back of a young 13, 14-year-old African-American girl. I wonder if he would have done that if the little girl who was dressed in a bikini was white.
No, I don't wonder. It would not have happened that way. I mean, it's why I brought this crazy Rachel Dolezal business into it, because, you know, she lied and she got herself in all kinds of trouble. But, you know, the thing that sticks in my mind about all that is that, you know, what if we could cross this divide? What if, you know, I could honestly say, I resent having to carry this history of whiteness and all that it brings to the table in, you know, the complications with other Americans. Just as African-Americans resent the burden of this history that comes with some serious violence and the possibility that you're going to die, so they're not equal by any means. But what if we could just shed these burdens on some level? If we could switch places, if we could just recognize what of this has been constructed by our history and then begin to change our history, you know what I mean?
It would be amazing to be able to walk in someone else's shoes, for me to be able to walk into a gentleman who is white and for them to walk in my shoes as a 52-year-old African-American male born and raised in Charleston, South Carolina, in the Deep South, clear understanding of the history of South Carolina and Strom Thurmond and going to a historically black college and university. Listening to the stories, as you indicated, from my mother or my grandmother and the stories they told me growing up as a young boy, I think there'll be a deeper appreciation. It's connected to the history, and the perpetrator in Charleston wants to relive that history from his perspective. He was given that history, and he wanted to replay it again in 2015. And so it was an attack on those individuals at church that night, but it was an attack on a race of people. It was an attack on the Christian church, and it was an attack on humanity. Humanity that night was attacked, and that should give all of us some type of pause.
Well, I would be wrong if I didn't allow you a few moments to reflect on the loss of your sister and just your thoughts about Cynthia Graham Hurd.
So hard. I love her to death. And I talk about her in the present, not in the past. So Cynthia is my sister. She is a wonderful librarian who served her community for some 31 years. She was a Christian. She had a stronger Christian walk than I ever will have. We were all born and raised in Emmanuel AME Church. That church has been in our family for well over 60 years. And I miss my sister. And I talked to you and others to keep her memory alive because that's what she would want me to do. And she would also want us as a nation to remember that that night, as I said again, can simply not be just a moment in time where we move on to the next thing, that there's hard work to do and heavy loads to lift. And each and every one of us has a moral obligation to do and say something about what we have to do next. Because again, it was not an attack on her or eight others or the church, but really it was an attack on humanity. And as humans, we have to do a lot better.
Well, Malcolm, finally, let me, with respect, if I could, just walk in the footsteps of your beaten heart right there as you think about your sister. Let's say she is alive. Let's say she is a librarian. Let's say I have questions about what happened at that church. And I go into that library and I say, what book, Cynthia, Ms. Hurd, would you recommend that I read to understand better about what the heck is going on in this country? What book do you think she'd recommend to me?
She would probably recommend Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. She would also recommend a book called The Measure of Our Success by Marion Wright Edelman that gives 24, 25 life lessons. One in particular talks about race in America and what we must do to confront it. She would refer us back to the Bible and said that Jesus loves all of us, and that we all are human in his eyes, and that we all have a sense of a moral obligation to do what is right.
Well, thank you, Cynthia, for those recommendations, and thank you, Malcolm Graham, for sharing and for speaking so honestly with us today on The Takeaway. Thanks so much.
John, thank you for the opportunity.
Malcolm Graham is a former North Carolina State Senator and Charlotte City Councilman and the brother of Cynthia Graham Hurd.
Support for PRI's The Takeaway comes from TIAA Cref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The pressure is on for Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, with hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets this week calling for her impeachment and the prosecution of other senior officials in the $1.7 billion Petrobras scandal that is threatening to bring Brazil to a halt. From the city of Rio de Janeiro, Bruce Douglas, Brazil correspondent for Latin America Newsletters, joins us. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi.
So first of all, what does President Rousseff face?
President Dilma Rousseff faces a whole range of problems. The people who were in the streets on Sunday were calling for her impeachment based on two possible reasons. One is that she used money from the Petrobras corruption scandal to fund her re-election campaign last year. And two, that she used illegal accounting maneuvers to make the government's books look good last year. Now, both of these still lack the killer blow. There is no direct link between Dilma Rousseff and the corruption scandal at Petrobras. And as yet, the financial watchdog hasn't ruled on whether the government used illegal accounting maneuvers to balance its books last year. But the street pressure is growing, and that's partly due to the deteriorating economic situation. Unemployment is rising here, inflation is at close to 10%, and the economy is expected to contract by about 2% this year. So people are really feeling the pain, and that's contributing to this protest against her regime.
And in a narrative you perhaps would only find in Brazil, Eduardo Cunha, who's the Speaker of the Congress, has actually come out in favor of the impeachment, but he's just as much involved in the corruption as anyone else in the government.
Yes, that's right. Yesterday, it was reported in the Brazilian press that the public ministry, a body of independent prosecutors, is going to file charges against Eduardo Cunha for his role in soliciting a $5 million bribe from companies working with Petrobras. This complicates his position considerably, as you might imagine. He has been a bugbear for the government. He has been tabling motions in Congress that have undermined the Rousseff government's austerity program. And he has also expressed his support for those who wish to see her impeached. Now, what happens now is anyone's guess. Essentially, the Supreme Court has a few months to decide whether or not to go ahead and press these charges against Mr. Cunha. Now, in the meantime, it's possible that he may accelerate the plans to impeach the president. He may be so angry at the corruption charges leveled against him, which he believes the government is behind, that he may attempt to force the impeachment proceedings soon. However, the very fact that he has been accused of corruption somewhat undermines his position and makes him look increasingly isolated.
But of course, you have to feel real sympathy for the people in the streets of Brazil, because all of a sudden, there's no possibility of a knight in shining armor here. Eduardo Cunha is just as sullied as the president at this point. And it kind of reminds you of the old days where there would just be a simple coup. The transition here is going to be anything but quick.
And that is a source of major concern. Some analysts here are talking about the return to the bad old days of Brazil's chronic political instability. And it's worth pointing out that only once in the last 50 years has one democratically elected president from one party handed power to another democratically elected president from another party. Sadly, impeachment does seem to be a real possibility, which does have serious implications for Brazil's governability. There is serious questions about who would succeed the president or whether there might be fresh elections. One glimmer of light, I suppose, in this otherwise unrelenting gloom of this corruption scandal is the fact this case is being prosecuted with vigour and that some of the most powerful people in Brazil will face the consequences of their actions.
Bruce Douglas is Brazil correspondent for Latin American Newsletters. He spoke with us from Rio de Janeiro. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thanks a lot.
The heroin epidemic in America, street heroin and prescription opiates, are a local political problem, if not a crisis, in communities all around the country. The White House this week announced a $5 million initiative to shift the emphasis to treatment rather than prosecution and punishment. $5 million is less than most state lottery prizes. So it's no surprise that in July, the Arlington, Massachusetts Police Department launched the Arlington Outreach Initiative all by itself, a door-to-door approach that offers social services to addicts. It's a program funded by the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative, begun in the neighboring town of Gloucester. Arlington Police Chief Fred Ryan joins me now. Welcome, Chief.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So what are you doing here in the absence of real significant support from the federal government? You're taking matters into your own hands, and it sounds like you're being a little innovative here.
You know, while I applaud the president and the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, this really is less about throwing money at the problem and more about a shift in paradigm and a different philosophical approach to addressing addiction. What we've been doing for many years simply isn't working.
So if I'm in a household and I'm an addict, and say I'm a teenager, and by no means typical. I mean, this occurs with adults all ages, as you well know, but I'll just pick that just for an example. And you knock on the door. Is it the case that you will basically offer to forego any prosecution of whatever it is I've done in the course of being an addict, short of a violent crime, as long as I get treatment?
Right, and we have one such case just Tuesday evening this week where there's a young man that we know is in crisis with addiction and was, you know, well on his road to being our next red dot on a map of fatal overdoses. So we had to intervene. You know, when you look at the spectrum of addiction, there's prevention. We do a lot of work in the prevention area. There's intervention and then recovery. And this is in the intervention spectrum. And we've got to go out and go door to door and get overdose reversal Narcan in the hands of family members and loved ones, which we did in this particular case. And now with our treatment professionals, we're trying to get this kid placed. The police department have information relative to the identity of addicts in their communities. We know this through our drug investigations. At the conclusion of investigating a drug dealer, we know who their customers are. We know this from responding to 911 calls for overdoses. And historically, we've done nothing with the identity of those known addicts. And we've got to fill that void.
You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of the evolution away from straight-ahead combat in the military and more humanitarian efforts that the military is being brought into the sort of public health arena in, say, the Ebola crisis. And similarly, law enforcement can provide a huge service in concert with public health officials rather than simply redo the old script of the Bang Bang Cop show regarding drug enforcement.
Right. I mean, let's face it. We arrest somebody for simple possession of heroin. They go to the local courthouse where there's a circular door at the front of the courthouse. They go in, they pay their fine, they're back on the street within a half an hour using it again. That model does not work. And partnering with public health, not only to get services out to these addicts, but also to start to begin to address the issue related to the stigma associated with addiction. You know, we model our approach to the successful reentry programs where felons are paroled from prison. The old model used to be we give them a scarlet letter, call them a felon, not give them a job, not give them a home, and then what would happen? They'd reoffend. No surprises there, right? So same thing with addiction. People that go off to detox and into recovery and then return to the community, their neighborhoods and the community have labeled them a junkie and not provided the environment in which they might thrive in recovery. So we're trying to turn that on its head and truly treat this as a public health crisis where addicts need support, a supportive environment where they can work on their recovery.
Fred Ryan is the police chief of Arlington, Massachusetts. Thanks so much, Chief.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
On Tuesday, a group of hackers claimed to have dropped 9.7 gigabytes of stolen user data from members of Ashley Madison, very familiar name by now, a website aimed at people looking to strike up an extramarital affair. It's supposedly confidential data, now public. Some upstanding members of the public, perhaps, facing some serious emotional trouble in the next few weeks. Ashley Madison is a very interesting case. It's a very old business model with a very new business platform, the Internet, and a claim of some 40 million users. And there aren't really many hotels that could accommodate such an escort service. But just to show you how the issues for Ashley Madison's users and its owners aren't really that new, here's a conversation recalling a scandal from the 1980s. An astute businesswoman by the name of Sydney Biddle Barrows, with a, shall we say, agnostic sense of sexual morality, set up a business in Washington, D.C. and New York that offered clients the opportunity to have a discreet sexual relationship for a fee. It was very successful until the whole thing unraveled because of the police. Here she is with a colleague recalling lessons learned in an interview in the 1990s.
These men are not looking for another relationship. They love their wives. They just want a little variety on the side. And I think that, you know, a woman who's secure in herself and knows her husband really loves her certainly is not going to be thrilled if her husband goes to
an escort. I don't think she should know about it anyway.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I think if he has any respect for her at all, he will make sure she never finds out.
That's the good thing about your kind of situation, is that the wife really doesn't find out. But if he goes to escort services and little kind of things, somebody might see him, and he might be found out, where yours is completely confidential, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Yeah, oh, very confidential.
Very confidential, right. Well, before it exploded, Ashley Madison claimed it was the most famous name in infidelity and married dating. The site's homepage bragged that thousands of cheating wives and cheating husbands sign up every day looking for an affair, and with our affair guarantee package, we guarantee you will find the perfect affair partner. Moira Weigel is a PhD candidate at Yale in film and media. She's also researching a book entitled Labors of Love on the History of Courtship and Sex. Moira, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think of all this? Do you think what was going on in the 80s is exactly what was going on with Ashley Madison? Have things changed in some significant way?
Well, there are certainly changes that strike me, but the first thing that occurred to me just now listening to that was that Ashley Madison is not an escort service. I mean, it's supposed to be a platform for sex between mutually consenting adults. It's not exchanging a fee, so...
Although you do sign up, and there is a fee for signing up.
Right. Yeah. I believe there's a fee for male users.
Yeah.
Why that struck me is it's been rather surprising to me. Maybe it shouldn't be surprising to me, but how viscerally angry the reaction about it is and how sort of like blatantly gleeful a lot of people on the internet are about the idea of these cheaters being exposed and the idea that all that information about private figures, you know, private individuals should be, that those people should be discovered. I was surprised by how emphatically people seem to think that.
Well, let me say, I'm not surprised by blatant glee on the internet, that's for sure. What do you think the difference is between men and women at Ashley Madison? Men, their sort of interest in multiple sexual partners is perhaps well known anthropologically.
Yeah.
For women, though, it seems like much of the motivation comes from the problems with the institution of marriage for women, that in many ways, particularly in this era, economically, it's something of a trap.
I mean, I think often of how affairs were conducted or of infidelity in that Victorian era, or even in the 1950s, you know, more recent, the Mad Men era or something like that. And it's very hard to separate from power relations and economic power in a relationship. I remember reading a study a few years ago, and I can't remember who conducted it, but of British couples. And one of the questions these sociologists, I think, asked over the phone of two married women was, if you could afford it, would you leave your husband tomorrow? And some staggering number of them said yes. So all of that is a way of saying, you know, if women are more economically empowered and have more economic options, it makes sense perhaps that they'd take some of that prerogative that used to belong to Don Draper or, you know, Mr. Victorian era.
Or if Ashley Madison offers a secret passageway to something that otherwise would require a private jet and some, you know, Saudi prince to whisk you away to some island, it's a completely different situation.
That's very funny. I mean, I was thinking last night about this and how a lot of these mobile apps like Uber or Handy or Seamless are actually just delivering. Basically, they're taking experiences that were previously affordable only for the ultra wealthy and making them more democratically available or making it possible for more people to afford them. And I was thinking, is Ashley Madison just like that? Is it that, like, it's really expensive and a lot of work to have an affair, and it's making it more possible for people who don't have the private jet?
So they need a new slogan. Ashley Madison takes all the work out of your extramarital affair.
The Uber for swinging.
Oh, God. We're going to get in trouble now. Myra Weigel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Myra Weigel is a PhD candidate at Yale and researching a book entitled Labors of Love, due out in 2016 on the history of courtship and sex.
Hi, this is Jack from Council Bluffs, Iowa. In my first marriage, I cheated on my wife. I was immature and stupid. In my second marriage, my wife cheated on me. My third wife and I have been married for going on 27 years. So that's the way it goes.
Hi, this is Missy Dallahan in Austin, Texas. I've been pondering this question lately while witnessing the pain of a friend whose husband ruined her and her three young kids' lives by an affair. I've always told my husband I have just never had sex that was so good that I would destroy all the people that I love most for it. I just don't get it. But I've come to believe that the reason people cheat is because of the excitement factor.
Hi, this is MJ calling from Nutley, New Jersey. I never physically cheated, but have emotionally cheated on someone. I have had romantic partners physically and mentally cheat on me. I think lack of communication and unrealistic expectations push people to cheat. Not wanting to face or admit something is not working, yet not wanting to be the one to speak up creates a passive-aggressive environment, which is a breeding ground for cheating behavior.
You guys are unbelievable. You are so honest. I just love you all. Your stories of cheating,
I sort of hate to ask for them, but it's beautiful stuff. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'd love to hear about your lives, and we actually do care. And here's something to take with you today. We played some of President Obama's vacation Spotify playlist, you may remember the other day. Miles Davis, Van Morrison, Bob Dylan, some Sinatra. And also, that track, La Salsa La Traigo Yo, is by a Colombian salsa band called Sonoro Carruseles, founded in Medellin, Colombia in 1995. They got 14 albums. The band, though, at first thought it was a joke to be on the president's playlist. That song, they say, is one they haven't played in a very, very long time. One of the band members told the Associated Press, quote, "Now everything has changed. In these few days, more people know about us. They want to know who we are, where we come from, and to learn more about our music. For us, it is very important that Obama has put us on the map." Now, the White House's official position is that the president picks his own playlist tunes, period. No other information. But we're thinking of a little business here at The Takeaway, making a website called Presidential Payola, where you send your demo to us, pay us a fee. It'll probably be pretty large. And we'll get it on the president's playlist. Huh? Huh? That's a felony, Vince? That's a felony? All right. Never mind. Rate our show. Leave us a comment on iTunes. It helps other users find us. You know how to reach us. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.